boy, yeah, she looks great while she's being monstrous, right? And so go with her. And so, yeah, there is that dynamic. Now, you've identified a few of the things that actually really hurt the film, namely that, yes, when you hear the old songs, it's like hearing old friends. And so what do you want to do? You want to go back and watch the 1937 original version of it. You know, correspondingly in terms of how cute the critters were, and the CGI critters are cute, but again, a reminder of, wouldn't this whole thing be better as an animated film?
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we are going to talk about Mickey 17 and Snow White. Mike, starting with Mickey 17, I mean, how do you follow up a movie like Parasite? I mean, it was such a big hit. It was so different. It was so unusual. It was such a crowd pleaser in a lot of ways. That's a tough movie. You know, if you start off with that, how do you come back with something else?
That's precisely my concern as well, because Parasite from 2019 was both critically and commercially, you know, a great success. And it really, you know, for Bong Joon-ho, the director, it's a career high water mark, right? So what do you do next? It's the problem of success, if you will. What do you do after a great hit like that? And yes, I did think about that. And one of the reasons why I find Mickey 17 a little disappointing is just simply that perhaps unreasonably I'm thinking about Parasite and, you know, this isn't quite at that level. But I have a very specific reason for feeling a bit disappointed here. First of all, with Mickey 17, there's the premise. The title character, Mickey, played by Robert Pattinson and played very well, is living in a future world, 2054 to be exact. So it's near future in a lot of ways. And when we think about the seeming miracles of 3D printing and what we're doing now, this is like the next step where, you know, you could have a human worker, I'll call him a drone even, like a near slave-like worker, And you know, you give him the most dirty and dangerous of jobs, and if he gets injured or killed on the job, oh well, no problem, just print out another copy of him. And so hence the title, Mickey 17. And from the perspective of that character, it's a rather troubling existence, because you find yourself being pushed into like really horrific situations out way out in outer space, you know, this distant colony with all sorts of threats. And, you know, who are going to send out there all alone out across the desert sands? I know, we'll send Mickey. And you know, he kind of shakes his head and goes out and does it and get bumped off and then back again. So anyway, it's that sort of serial progression of one iteration of Mickey to the next and where he is at this stage in his, I should say, life or lives. I don't know how to describe it even. But so that's it's a nifty sci-fi premise. I have no trouble with that. The performance, as I've said, is a good one. Certainly the director is capable right down the line. The problem I have essentially is that I don't think the film is quite as clever as it thinks it is. And one reason why I feel that way is simply that it's so drawn out. And I know this may seem like a fixation on my part, but in terms of running times, but it has a running time of 137 minutes, mm-hmm. which is so excessive. If this film were easily 30 to 40 minutes shorter, if we're really tighter that way, it would hold together. It'd be amusing and disturbing and all the things it should be. Here it gets to the point where it's just, speaking of printing out multiple versions, it's just reprinting the same basic situation in a way that for me has diminishing returns. So I'm diminished at that point, and I turn it back to you.
I agree with you that Robert Pattinson was really good in this, because he does a good job of playing two different characters. You know, when you're looking at Mickey 17 versus Mickey 18. And that's a pretty tricky thing to be able to do, to be that convincing when it's, you know, you doing both roles. I agree with you. And I have the same obsession with the length of the movie. You really have to have some added value to make people sit there for that long. And I'm with you. I thought these scenes were way too drawn out. And actually, I thought the second half of the movie was not as promising as the first. I thought it, because in the first, everything was just so, like, plausible. Of course, they couldn't do it anywhere on Earth because it was illegal, so they had to do it out in space somewhere, right? This whole process of having these expendable people. And the printing was just, it was like an old dot matrix printer, the way it worked. And if nobody was paying attention, then it fell on the floor. And I thought those things were really funny and smart. But when you get to, you know, what I thought of the larval sandworms, I thought, wait, are we in Dune? What happened here?
Yeah, I think we are in Dune at that point, because this is where, by way of sci-fi tropes, the director almost seems to be scrambling a bit, as in, okay, now we've been out here for a while, the audience knows the situation, we're going to reprint them again, that kind of thing. What do you do next? And I think that's where there's a kind of automatic pilot, I think, operating in the film at that point. So yeah, you're going to have, you know, you start thinking about sandworms and Dune and things like that. And I think there, they just sort of fall back on reliable sci-fi scenarios or landscapes, literally there. But I think what also happens in the second half that hurts the film is, you know, I like the way in which in the first half of the film, you have to get your grounding, you have to get your bearings. And that's interesting just to try to figure out what the deal is here, right? But within about 20 minutes, you sort of know the deal. And then for the first hour or so, it's quite interesting. It's quite funny in the ways that you've tabulated. The problem I have more with the second half of the film is, as I say, that to be redundant, that it's redundant, really, with a lot of what it's doing there. But the major problem there actually is that even though it's been amusing, it slides into what I call live action cartoon at a certain point. For instance, the boss of bosses, if you will, Kenneth Marshall's the character name, Mark Ruffalo is the actor. He's a former congressman turned cult leader. And you know, we can take from that what we will by way of our own political views. But the fact that he's so outlandish, he's so unreasonable, he's such a monstrous figure. But, you know, that can wear thin after a while with an audience. It's like, ooh, give me a break from this guy, you know, and he's just relentless that way. And the cult leader's wife, Aoife, played by Toni Collette. Again, in small doses, that could be very funny. But in like that second hour of the film, it's just like, you know, it's not so funny. And it's kind of grating after a while. It's just like, I'm not happy to see them again. And then there is what's meant to be sort of a quasi love interest between our protagonist and a character named Nasha, played by Naomi Ackie. And that's sort of an interesting potential plot twist. But I don't know, to me, it just seemed like sort of arbitrary and tossed in, and it'd be there for a while and then not be there for a while. And it never felt, to me at least, and let me ask you about this, it never felt fully realized at the level of like character development. I'll call it human interaction, though. I don't know what to do with all the 3D printing, but 3D printing interaction.
yeah, that was an interesting relationship, quote unquote, because I didn't think they really had that much chemistry as two separate actors. And I've seen her in other things and liked her. So I enjoyed that they, you know, gave us an extra character to follow and, you know, somebody to be in peril, because, you know, you always have to have somebody in peril. I completely agree with you about Mark Ruffalo and Toni Collette, two actors I really, really like. And you're right, it was grating after a while because it was very cartoonish. It was very, you know, Boris and Natasha doing things to Bullwinkle. It was you know, just that level of snarky humor, which I don't think landed very well. I think there was too much of that.
So it's Boris and Natasha and Nasha, right?
It's
a trio. But see that where, again, where it falls on some, you know, considering how innovative it is potentially from the start, just an interesting premise and so on, that it falls back on sort of tired tropes and landscapes in a way. And so then, you know, you do get into the quasi cartoonish characters, but then also the fact that, you know, that she will be literally the damsel in distress, if you will, that, you know, we need a woman now who's going to be endangered in some way. And that sort of goes back to like the silent film cliffhangers, you know, I mean, it almost goes back to that level of thing there. I think, geez, but you've identified actually an additional problem there, which is namely, you know, you've got capable actors, but something harder to define is chemistry. And I didn't quite feel that ever between those two characters. That's why when I say that it seemed like it was a blossoming romance, or at least close friendship, or at least we're on the same side feeling, it never felt to me like that. Like this was something that had to be, as in here's your soulmate that you've met, you know, on this distant planet. It seemed more like the script writers and director deciding we need to do something else here. We need the act three, right? We need something to take it to the finale. And that's where it again seemed rather arbitrary in a very conventional way, like, okay, well, let's have, you know, her there and they can help each other out and so on. But, you know, at a certain point, it's just a lot of running down hallways and across, you know, dusty plains. So, yeah, it's an action movie that way, but felt expendable in its own way.
Good use of expendable there. So he was not Mr. Right, but Mr. Right Now.
Yeah, that's true, though, again, even at the level of like potential romantic lead or partnership, the movie like barely scratches the surface of anything like that. I'm getting at it. It's not It's not one of these films where you feel like romantically they're meant for each other and you're rooting for them and there'll be a big, you know, embrace at the end. And no, I'm not saying I want that necessarily in the film, but you know, you want something between these two characters other than the sense that they're both facing the same threat and they're going to help each other out, and they do kind of sort of like each other, and so some goo-goo eyes made periodically, but it just seemed to me at the very basic psychological level of who are these people, there's not much there. They're human, but but they're in this strange situation, and I don't know, I want a fuller expression of humanity. I mean, I'm putting it in kind of weird terms, but you know what I'm getting at there. I want some sense of these as two real people, and I'm rooting for them. Instead, I just found myself following the mechanics of the plot. And again, it's well staged on a technical level, so I had no trouble watching it.
I think the reason that they had to have the love interest is because the director is sort of playing with the ideas of cloning, you know, and what sort of ethical problems arise. So, you know, they think Mickey, one of the Mickeys is dead, so they go ahead and print a new one, and then there's two of them. And the girlfriend is sort of delighted by this because they're very different versions of him. One's kind of angry bad boy, and the original is, you know, still, you know, the guy she met. So I think in order to play with that idea, they had to create that scene. What do you think, Mike?
Well, that scene is actually interesting and it cuts back in a healthy way against a lot of what I've just been saying. In other words, that you could actually have a sort of, not quite a menage a trois, but a sort of triangular relationship of some sort there. And so, yeah, that was interesting. But for me, it wasn't like fully followed through on, you know, so... the performer is good. You're right. Pattinson does a good job of sort of showing, you know, two iterations of the same character. And then, of course, her quandary is to, well, you know, gee, I've struck gold here. I got everything I could want in a guy because it's spread between two guys. And so that could lead to a wonderful outer space melodrama of sorts. But to me, it was squandered because ultimately, you know, which one who she should go for and who she should care about and so on. And so it doesn't take all that long for that to sort of work its way through the ringer in the script. And then it really just will be, you know, the guy she really cares about, you know, and Nasha, you know, helping each other and running away and you know, running towards the finale. So let me pick your brain again on that one, because I think you raised an interesting issue that as it gets into that third act, that is really potentially a fascinating way to take the film out. But do you feel like it really followed through on that? It does for at least a few scenes, I suppose. But doesn't that seem to just like dissipate or go? It sort of goes away? As a thematic concern?
It absolutely does. That's one of the problems with the film. And I think it's because it's too long and it spends too much time on the battle scenes, which I didn't think. I thought the more interesting stuff was the psychological things that were going on with, you know, the multiple versions of Mickey. And, you know, if you're going to do something interesting with it, you know, there'd have to be some planet where Boris and Natasha are purposely printing several copies of the same person.
Do you know who would have been a better director for this film? And I'm thinking about it because he has a new film coming out as we speak, is David Cronenberg.
Yes.
Because Cronenberg, you know, specializes in what's called body horror.
Yes.
And what could be a better premise for David Cronenberg than to take this into outer space where you'd be printing out multiple copies of the same person and then a woman falling in love with one or two or several or a horde of them. She falls in love with everybody on the planet. I mean, that could be like so funny and so scary. So there should be a remake directed by David Cronenberg.
All right, I'm with you on that one. That was classic. So let's move on to Snow White. Now, this poor film has just been so beleaguered and it has to follow a classic that people absolutely love. So I think it kind of, it was not as bad a movie as I thought it was going to be based on all of the press that I was trying not to listen to before I watched it. How did you approach it, Mike?
Well, I had been exposed to all that press beforehand, so I, you know, I was predisposed for what I was going to get, and I got it. It's a mediocre film. I mean, it's easy to pick it apart for what could be better, but you know, it's an easy watch. It's okay. That's not exactly high praise, but it's well made mediocre filmmaking. And the real problem here is, again, speaking of cloning, you take a 1937 animated classic to remake it, either animated or in this case live action, it's at your peril, right? I mean, you're taking a certified classic like that and redoing it. And in a kind of knee-jerk way, that's how they do it in this live-action remake. And it falls prey immediately to what I call the power princess syndrome, namely that when you have, you know, Snow White here, okay, so, you know, here she is as a live-action character, but as if it weren't enough to be alive that way, she's a social activist. So again, in terms of how I vote, you know, I would vote for her on a lot of these issues, right? You know, she's trying to rouse the people and go up against an evil queen and this and that. But boy, thematically, it hits you with a sledgehammer at times. And so it's just relentless that way. And I think, you know, I thought, well, give me a break here. And in terms of what I call the social media, you know, tempest in a teapot, the fact that Rachel Zegler, who plays Snow White, is Latina, to me, it was not an issue at all. I'm watching it and picking it apart in various levels. But the social media storm, and this is a matter of whether you decide to rise to the bait or not rise to the bait in terms of stuff that goes out in social media. But, you know, there the criticism was, well, you know, that is Snow White white, basically, to put it crudely. I'm generally shying away from even getting into that whole discussion because it seems silly and useless to me on so many levels. But the fact that, you know, in the animated film, I sardonically think not only was she was Snow White white, but she was like porcelain white. She was like whiter than white. And I thought even most white women today couldn't match that degree of whiteness in an animated film. So I think essentially I mentioned that because it has to be talked about, I suppose, because it's been out there in the social media verse, if you will. But just sort of kick it aside at that point. So what? I mean, you know, and Rachel Zegler, she's fine in the role. I can't fault her. The songs she sings are, it's a mix of old songs and new songs. The new songs are all mediocre, as is the overall film, but they go by pleasantly enough. I mean, I can't remember a single one of them, but they go by pleasantly. But then in terms of the social activism of this, she needs the love interest, of course. And in this case, it's a character, Jonathan, played by Andrew Burnett. Now, he's no Prince Charming in terms of his societal status. He is picture book handsome, as he should be, but it's significant here that he's a commoner. He's a man of the people. So there are a lot of scenes in the film where as they're pulling together the populace and going up against the evil queen, played by Gal Gadot, as they're doing all that, there were production numbers, and it's an overproduced film, but there were big production numbers that I thought were something right out of Les Miserables. I mean, it was just sort of, you know, man the barricades and up against this authoritarian queen and so on. And I thought, oh, brother, you know, this is too much. And so my final major complaint about it is the Seven Dwarfs. Now, in the animated classic, they are very much storybook characters. And we all saw that film back when we were kids, and you can still remember them and their names and their attributes. They were adorable. They were grumpy and quite literally sometimes, and they had these character traits. The problem here in the live action version is they are more or less human. I mean, there's some motion capture and there's, you know, puppetry and CGI and things, and you know, so there's a sense of humanity here. But in this case, it becomes a really weird scenario and unintentionally, because here's Snow White. And she's living with, for a while, like these seven guys or kind of sort of guys. And it seems like borderline creepy, even, you know, the way they're depicted, that they're human, but sort of grotesque. And even putting it very politely, okay, she's living with seven vertically challenged guys, you know. But once she's in that household, how quickly it reverts to gender stereotypes, ironically. Well, who's going to do the cooking and cleaning and keep house? Well, she is. She's Snow White. She's really good with a broom, you know. And so the film, on one hand, is like really progressive, that she's the power princess and pushing ahead. But on the other hand, it immediately falls back on that one of the oldest stereotypes, that somebody's got to keep house, and so she will, and cheerfully. But this is one case where I think the film was much better vis-a-vis the Seven Dwarfs, when they really were storybook creatures. Here they're like human, but not quite or fully human, and it just seems like a kind of unusual household, you know. It's just sort of, I don't know how they would fill out the Census Bureau data on this one, but it just takes into a kind of realm that I'm not sure it's very happily dwelling in. What do you think?
Wow, so many thoughts. I'll try to address everything you said, because you made some great points. You're right about the social justice part, because Snow White has to do everything. You know, she's got the dwarves who are on her side and willing to fight for her, but she doesn't really need them. And, you know, the Jonathan characters has a merry band of misfits in the woods that are trying to find the true king, et cetera. And she doesn't really need them either. She does everything herself. So it kind of makes all of those characters, all that buildup, for nothing in the end. Okay. I have never seen such an unconvincing wig since Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity. What was with that Lord Farquhart wig? Hideous. And the costumes looked so cheap. Honestly, what they put Rachel Zegler in was just the ugliest thing. It looked like something you would buy for your kid to wear for Halloween. Terrible, terrible costumes. I thought that the dwarves were kind of cool. I thought they were rendered very interestingly. I didn't pick up the weird vibe that you did, Mike, but now I'm afraid I probably will if I watch it again. The musical numbers, the new ones, were absolutely forgettable, but the old ones were kind of like old friends. It was kind of fun to hear those hi-ho songs and, you know, just actually remind you of what you liked about the original one. The movie is too long, again, especially since most people wanted to bring kids to this movie. I thought that the CGI animals, though, were so incredibly charming. That hedgehog at the end, you know, climbing up on the storybook. I mean, I thought the animals were just adorable. Major problem I had was Rachel Zegler, I thought, was a great singer. I thought her acting was just okay. But, and I don't think, I think she's an attractive woman, but she is not more beautiful than Gal Gadot in anybody's world. I just found that so ridiculous. Gal Gadot was fun, though. I mean, every time she moved, there was like all these jewels that clanked and clacked, and she just ate that scenery up. I think she was having the best time. What did you think of her performance, Mike?
Well, it's always more fun to play evil than to play good. And so, you know, she is the evil queen, right? And she lives up to it. But you're right. She's so over the top, glamorous in a lot of ways that I'm thinking, like, why don't the people support her? You know, like, I mean, I know she's monstrous in a lot of her behavior, but boy, you know, she looks great while she's being monstrous, right? And so go with her. And so, yeah, there is that dynamic. Now, you've identified a few of the things that actually really hurt the film, you know, namely that, yes, when you hear the old songs, it's like hearing old friends. And so what do you want to do? You want to go back and watch the 1937 original version of it. You know, correspondingly, in terms of how cute the critters were, and the CGI critters are cute. But again, a reminder of, wouldn't this whole thing be better as an animated film? Mm-hmm. Right? Because that's what you liked in it. Those are the songs, the old songs, the animation. And nowadays, you know, here's an ironic thing to say. The 1937 version was Disney's first full-length, feature-length animated film, and it remains one of their very best, right? It's just gorgeously animated, so beautiful. So even though today, ironically, we have, you know, obviously a higher technological capability, I'm not sure we'd get even more beautiful results. I mean, you know, a really beautiful painting from the Renaissance remains really beautiful, you know, and I'm not sure we're going to top it. But it would be interesting to see a fully animated remake of it that way. Now, I'm not asking for it, please. Don't give it to me. But you know, I think going in that direction. In terms of, you know, her relationships with Jonathan and the dwarfs and all, you make a really good point that because she is the power princess. She really can do it on her own. And the other elements were told are necessary or somehow essential, but they seem superfluous in the telling. You're right. So that's a real issue. As to how that household is constituted, I suppose I planted that idea in you. But think about it. It's just, I know I'm all for like unconventional households, but Marie, that one's sort of out there, right? So I'm not quite sure what to make. And see, that's not as much of an issue in an animated film because you make allowance for all sorts of things. But when it is quasi-realistic, as the dwarfs are, I start to think on a more mundane level. And whether I should be mundane and logical is a whole other thing to go into. But I am in this case, as in, well, gee, you know, where do they all sleep? How do they share the household finances? Do they have like, you know, one credit card or eight? I mean, how do they handle things like this?
See, now you're going to make them make another movie and explain all that for you. I did want to mention that I had read this, that in the original Snow White movie, they had a plot line where the queen threw the prince in the dungeon, but they didn't have enough skill to do yet another person in all of the animation. So they just cut that out. So I do think it's sort of fun that they got to get that in there, in their retelling this time.
Yeah, and I suppose that was deliberate and that they knew that history the way you know it. And but they get themselves into a lot of trouble here because, you know, you take a classic like that, if you're going to remake it, do you do it chapter and verse or do you change certain things? And the changes they made, I don't think are always for the better. I have no qualms with Rachel Zegler taking that role because, I mean, physically she's appropriate for it, you know. And when I say physically, I mean like personality as much as anything. I mean, she's got a good singing voice. But she's only okay as an actress here. She's not, it's not a very, I don't know how deep a performance I would want. You know, I don't know, I'm not sure I want the full method, you know, applied to this, but it's really kind of superficial, isn't it? It's really just sort of, in an animated version, that might not be as much of a concern because you could say, well, everything's flat there. You know, it's all cartoon action. But here, you know, somehow you want maybe a little more character depth or likewise with her relationship with Jonathan. He's essentially just a pretty face. I mean, he comes along at the right moment and he's on the right side there for social justice. But again, you don't feel like this is some great romance. It's just like two attractive people put in the same frame together.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I did, you know, I did say that I thought that the costuming and the hair was terrible, but I do have to give snaps to Gal Gadot for 4 hours in the makeup chair to become the crone, because that was very well done.
Well, it was, but that's at the level of you know, craft services where I can appreciate that, but that's where you find yourself, you know, saying, gee, that's a well designed set, or gee, that's an interesting costume she has on. And when you find yourself thinking about those things, it takes you away from things you should be thinking about by way of character and storyline and, you know, those thematic elements. So it's sort of a mixed bag that way. It's overproduced, but underwhelming, if I can put it that way. Obviously, a lot of money went into it and big production numbers, but sometimes it does seem kind of chintzy. You're right with a lot of the costuming and so on. And it's kind of hard to explain that because it was a big budget film. And that this may explain why we're not the only ones who harbor these reservations about it. The film did not open well, and it fell very quickly in its second week as we speak about it. So it's not really doing particularly well at the box office. I'm hoping in a way, ironically, that people just stay home and on their own watch the 1937 version.
Well, you can't go wrong with the 1937 version. But I just want to say one other thing about that makeup, that I was impressed that Gal Gadot was willing to make herself look that ugly, because the rest of the movie she looks incredible.
Well, it takes hours in the chair to look that ugly, you know.
Well, that brings us to the end of yet another episode, but don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com, and we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.